Hello, and welcome to the Asymptote Podcast. My name is Daniel, and I'll be taking over running this thing from Emma. She did an amazing job, and I'm pretty nervous about the really big shoes I have to fill. But hey, let's do this. Before we begin, I'd like to say that Close Approximations, Asymptote's hugely popular translation contest, is back. The winner will receive $1,000. The deadline to apply is December 15th. You can find out more at asymptotejournal.com/contest. Also, our 5-year anniversary is just around the corner. Be sure to keep an eye out for events taking place literally all over the world. Okay, let's start the podcast. Where is home? What is home anyway? Is it the house you grew up in? Did you move to a different house? Did you move to a different city? A different country? Where is your home? And how did it make you, you? This month, we're looking at questions of identity, how you shape it, and how it shapes you. We spend our lives crafting our life story, and how we shape it impacts how we live our lives. Are you an idealistic paladin fighting against the forces of evil? Are you an anti-hero walking the line between right and wrong? Are you a rebel fighting the system? We like to think that we write the stories of our lives, but all of our lives emerge out of a single point that we have no control over, our homes. We can leave them, we can try to forget about them, but they will always be with us and shape us. Our first segment is from Yardin, our Israeli editor-at-large, and is about acid. Particularly acid flashbacks. One usually associates acid with the counterculture, Ginsberg, Kerouac, that whole lot. But before it was banned in the 60s, acid, or LSD, was actually used as a psychiatric drug. The idea was to use it to open up the mind to make patients more receptive towards regular talk therapy. Research into LSD therapy has seen a resurgence in the past couple years, particularly as a way to help terminally ill patients cope with what's to come. Yardin has compiled a really fantastic and moving collection of short stories and poems that, in different ways, recount acid flashbacks of traumatic events. I'll let her take it from here.
Each generation of Israelis has its wars, and each generation has found its unique combination of healthy and harmful ways of dealing with the trauma. For one generation, it might have been alcohol. For another, psychotherapy. For many, it has been writing. For the earlier Israeli generations, whatever traumas were accumulated were justified, more or less believably, by the Israeli dream, the threat of no longer having our own country. For my generation, things got a little more complicated than that. The dream was crashing down, and the idea of merely defending a promised land became harder and harder to sell. The wars, however, and the desire to stay alive persisted, and so my generation traveled. My generation went to raves in secluded spots all over the world and found chemical ways of losing itself. And now my generation is writing about it. Yonatan Berg is a poet, fiction writer, and bibliotherapist. He grew up in a religious settlement and studied in a yeshiva as a teenager, experiences which he draws upon in his writing. His novel, 5 More Minutes, revolves around the trajectory of 2 brothers who grow up in a settlement much like Berg's, only to be thrown off on different paths. While one becomes entrenched in battles of ideology and extremism, the other travels to Southeast Asia and experiments with drugs. Berg writes honestly and bravely about losing and finding one's way, about the magic and the horror of the settlements, and about the terrors of war. In the following scene, an LSD trip at a rave conjures a flashback to one night in Gaza, in the midst of 2002's Operation Defensive Shield.
The yelling from the house brings them back. Aner has already gone over there. Yoav makes sure there are no explosives on the body and drags it between the trees. The clumps of dirt he throws on it slide down the man's face into the sides, and Yoav keeps piling dirt on him, more and more, covering the gaping mouth that is no longer crying and the gaping eyes that are no longer enraged, only defeated. His hands become stained with mud, a brown and red mixture collecting under his fingernails. He keeps piling up dirt until the face is partially hidden. Someone calls him from far away. He hears his voice called out in two voices. They are startled, thinking he'd been abducted. He abandons the body by the tree trunk, covered in dirt. That is the image he sees before him, time after time. The limp arms and the clumps falling off the dead face. Shlomi is standing at the entrance to the house. "Come on, you idiot, we have to get out of here," he says, when they see the old man coming down the steps in a white gown, reaching down to his feet. Shlomi aims his rifle and calls for him to stop, but the old man shows no signs of fear. He's holding something, and as he comes closer, they can see it's a belt. He motions to Seagal, and they think he is signaling for them to get out, but then they realize it is the terrorist's father. He knows his son is dead. You can see it in his body. He points to Seagal's neck and raises the belt again. He wants to use it to stop the bleeding. Shlomi stops him with his hand. "It isn't sterile," he says. "I'm sorry, Gramps, but it isn't sterile. You can't use it." And at that moment, Seagal dies, suddenly collapsing on the blue sofa, the air leaving his body, sending a tremor through it. His neck no longer spurting blood. The blood comes out slowly now, no less of it, but no longer fast. Shlomi tries to give him mouth to mouth, blowing into his lips and pounding his chest, blowing and pounding, sweat running down his face. He keeps at it, but it's clear this is a lost cause. Nobody speaks. They are left without a commander in this village home. They know they have to get out of there, but they just keep watching Seagal, limp, on that blue sofa. To this day, he continues to see Seagal, limp, on that blue sofa. Yoav gets up and looks for shelter. Then he remembers they're at a party and sits back down. The loudspeakers beat in the distance, accompanied by a whistling as the beat quickens to a brief moment of loaded pause, after which the whistling starts up again and the calls of the dancers thunder before falling apart into wild groans of joy. The gunshots spray tiny stones at them, and they let go of Seagal and jump in between the trees. Yoav is dancing. His movements loosen up, gaining heat with each passing moment, letting his body lead him. At the same time, he realizes, knows, decides that something must be done. Go, move, find out what happened exactly, what part he had in it, and what part of it will remain in the end.
Ron Dehan is a poet and fiction writer. He has published 3 poetry collections and a novel, Come As You Are. His poetry book, Youth, has received critical and popular acclaim and has recently been adapted into a music album in collaboration with Farthest South. In this collection, Dehan skates seamlessly between his time in Lebanon during the Second Lebanon War and his travels in Germany, Australia, Japan, and India. These shifts of time and space are rendered ever more undistinguishable by his experimentation with drugs, superimposing trauma and its healing. Time and place happen all at once. He is constantly trapped and liberated, everywhere and nowhere.
We walked and walked and walked and climbed and walked and arrived at the edge of the village. And we shot and ducked and smoked and feared and regretted and drank and ran and cried and sweated and sat and prayed and were and did not return. And we gathered the wounded and lied to the dead and never went home. We walked and walked and walked and climbed and walked and arrived at the edge of the village. And we smoked and got high and danced and sat and laughed and feared and smoked and moved and got confused and were and returned and ended and gathered the wounded and went home. LSD partial list. The entire Australian continent in my palm. The turtle's shell is my home. My mother's womb is wounded. It's bleeding internally. I place war at the foundation of consciousness. I place loss. I place death. LSD full price. A rhythmic bleeding of unrest. But near dances nonetheless. LSD bottom line. Remain in the stoned womb of youth, in the amniotic fluid of the sacred fall. Tomorrow a war will break. Somebody will turn off the music and turn on the night. Beware. You are merely a body which may be wounded and left lying in the corner of a garden, behind a large rock, exposed to death until somebody finds you.
Finally, we revisit one early and groundbreaking trauma flashback, a harbinger of today's genre. Yechiel Dinur, better known by his pen name, Katsetnik 135633, was a Polish-born Israeli writer and Holocaust survivor. In his writing, Dinur often drew on his experiences as a prisoner in Auschwitz. In the 1970s, he underwent experimental treatment that involved the use of LSD in order to cure him of traumatic nightmares and bouts of depression. In his book Shiviti, A Vision, he revisits what he saw and that in between.
What do you see, Mr. Dinur? What do you see? Speak to me. Tell me. The voice is carried from far away and comes to me. It is not dark outside at Auschwitz. There's a thick green light. The gates of the barracks are opened, and we stumble out just as we did when the doors of the cattle cars slid open onto the Auschwitz train platform. The barracks is packed with human skeletons, far beyond its capacity. Raus! Raus! Out! The shouts of the kapos, barracks chiefs, and barracks orderlies, Schneller! Schneller! Hurry up! Hurry up! No longer faze us. We drag ourselves along. I see a river of skeletons. One naked, noiseless body of skeletons, flawlessly acquiescent, flowing into the maw of the truck, myself among them. If only I could lift my head a bit. Air. A gulp of air. I'm choking. I'm drowning. Air! Air! Outside of the block, Auschwitz is altogether different from the one I have known so well, as intimately as my own skeleton. The electrified barbed wire is magnified as under the eye of a microscope, 10,000 times its normal size. The light of this Auschwitz dawn has substance to it, and I can reach out and touch it with my hand. Metallic, cobalt blue light. The same truck I had climbed up into that time feels different now. I see now what I couldn't see then. Now, as then, I help the rabbi of Shilev up, shielding his skull from the kapos club. But now the rabbi is light as a feather. I have the feeling now that I could lift up this whole truck together with all the skeletons in it, myself included. Suddenly, I know what no one else around me knows, and I cry out, Rabbi, why?
Because it was so decreed.
Rabbi, who decreed? Who decreed, Rabbi?
Ask God.
I cry out, God! God, who decreed? Who decreed? God! God, Auschwitz, whose is it?
I tremble as I lift my eyes to see the face of God in his initials, YHWH. But what I see instead is the face of the SS man, standing below the tailgate of the truck. Unfinished sleep is still on his face. This dawn is cold, and he keeps both hands in the pockets of his black greatcoat. He stands there watching the noiseless flow of a river of skeletons from the open gate of the barracks to the open maw of the truck, and his mouth opens wide in a long yawn. The same SS man, the same yawn, the same dawn now, just like then, when I climbed up onto the same truck. Only now I also see the Shivti, which I did not see then, and I call out, God, who created Auschwitz?
The thought of home can ruin a good moment or bring joy to a bad one. But in the worst cases, home can make you realize just how bad your situation is. Home is not a fixed point in time and space. It moves with you. It contrasts itself with everything you experience. Imagine you're at a party. It's in a nice place, plenty of booze, and some cheesy bossa nova is playing. It would be a good time, but you don't know anyone. So you strike up a conversation. You start out with the usual small talk, names, occupations, how you both ended up at this party. And then you get to a question that seems to come up during every moderately awkward conversation. Where are you from? It's a weird question. Not because it's hard to answer, you just have to give the name of a place, but because it's simple. Too simple. It's asking you to cram your entire personal history and maybe the history of your family into a single word. Where we're from molds us and shapes us. It tells us who we are or who we aren't. Asking where are you from and expecting anything short of a novel is unfair. So I've had this question on my mind for a while now. A couple of weeks ago, I went to the Brooklyn Book Festival, New York City's largest literary event, where I heard a lot of fantastic authors talk about their work, and the concept of place and how it's tied to a writer's work came up over and over again. I'm from Brooklyn, but I had never been to the festival before. I was a little nervous that it would succumb to the stereotypical image of the Brooklyn art scene, bearded hipsters on bicycles. Sure, those flannel-clad, pumpkin-spice-sipping hipsters exist, but Brooklyn is so much more than that. Brooklyn, like all of New York, is constantly changing and morphing. Each day, people from all over the world get off a boat, or a train, or a plane, and make Brooklyn their home. Flatbush is filled with Caribbean immigrants, Bensonhurst has those old Brooklyn Italians, Greenwood is Pakistani, Sunset Park is equal parts Hispanic and Chinese, and of course, Brighton Beach is chock full of Russians. Once you get past the bearded hipsters on bicycles, you find that Brooklyn is a culturally rich and complex place.
I came to New York for college, and that came as a shock. It was like the most diverse place I'd ever been, and you know, people were very proud of where they came from, and people were talking about it, and it was very different from what it was like in Oregon. And it kind of occurred to me when I was in New York that I would, you know, to a certain extent, always be defined by Hawaii, even though I had spent so much time growing up in Oregon, just because it was the place I was from, it's where most of my family still lives, and just the way that I look, you know, was something that, you know, I would have to reconcile with.
That was Cecily Wong, author of Diamond Head. So why does living in a culturally diverse place make someone learn more about themselves? And why is this so attractive to writers?
An outsider is the best way to be, because then it gives you a whole view, a bird's eye view of everything, of domestic life, of dysfunctional home, and then dysfunctional queens, and then, you know, always never fitting in and never being a part of a group. And what that longing is what led me to acting and to writing.
That was John Leguizamo, an actor, playwright, and author of Ghetto Clown. It's pretty impossible to not be an outsider in New York, and a great example of that was my middle school. So I was a white Jewish kid, and I went to Andreas Huddy Junior High School. I was in a magnet program, which meant that everyone in my class was from all over the borough, and that meant they were from all over the world. Togo, Egypt, Indonesia, China, Russia, there were students from all of these places in my class. By far, the biggest demographic was Caribbean, but that's not a monolith. So when I was with my friends trying to explain to them that I believe Jesus existed, but he was just a regular guy, and that it's called a yarmulke, not a Jew beanie, they were trying to explain to me the differences between Guyana, Haiti, St. Vincent, and the Dominican Republic. And sure, we could all go home to our respective neighborhoods, but it's not like we had to travel very far to feel like an outsider again. My middle school was on Nostrand Avenue. On one side was a Caribbean neighborhood filled with the sounds of patois and creoles, but on the other side was a Hasidic Jewish neighborhood, where all the store signs were in Yiddish. It's easy to feel like an outsider here. So, as John Leguizamo says, being an outsider is great for being a writer because it gives you a fresh perspective. But it's not like that perspective is totally objective. One's own past informs upon that perspective.
It is true. The character, the profile of the city, of the world has changed. That's why this is called global. But we don't experience the world globally. We experience it locally.
That was Vivian Gornick, a lifelong New Yorker and author of The Odd Woman in the City, and her quote has been bouncing around my head ever since the festival. We experience the global locally. That means that no matter where we travel, who we meet, what we do, we are still inextricably linked to where we're from. New places give us something with which we can contrast where we're from. Just look at Cecily Wong. It was only when she moved to New York that she realized how important Hawaii was to her identity. She experienced the diversity of New York, and it brought her that much closer to her own identity.
I sometimes think of New York as this machine producing Americans, right? It's where you come in as the immigrant, and you are thrown into some neighborhood, and you make these navigations. And if, you know, if it all goes perfectly according to the script, you move into the suburbs somewhere, and you are an American. But if it stops halfway, then you're a New Yorker.
That was Jonathan Lethem, author of Motherless Brooklyn and The Fortress of Solitude, and he's totally right. New York's identity as a city is made by the struggle its inhabitants face. The struggle to hold on to your past, now amplified in contrast to the city, while living in a new place and a new culture. It's that back and forth, that struggle, that makes New York, New York. The experience of being an outsider is twofold. You get that outsider's perspective of whatever world you're looking in on, but that perspective lets you see your own world all the more clearly. I grew up in Brooklyn. I live in Brooklyn, and other than my 4 years at college, I spent my entire life in Brooklyn. And every neighborhood has its own way of making me feel like an outsider. It kind of explains why I'm so into world literature. In fact, the act of engaging with world literature is a lot like living in New York. When you read a book from another language, another culture, you get a fresh look at that culture, but you also engage with your own.
And the same pressures that affect women in Nigeria affect women here, but in just different ways. You know, and so maybe in Nigeria, women will not be thinking about freezing eggs, but she is definitely thinking about how and when to get married. And the same thing with LGBT rights. When I write my story, people say, oh, why is she writing that? We've moved beyond that here in the US. That is not a problem. Is it really a problem in Nigeria? Wow, that is so sad. And so, but you know, the truth is, I know people in the US who have faced discrimination. We all do, you know.
That was Nigerian novelist Chinelo Okparanta, author of Under the Udala Trees. And I think what she says really rings true. You can't pass judgment on another culture without examining your own. The weaknesses you think you perceive in someone else's culture may be just as present in your own. If you're just looking at other cultures to maintain the image of your own as superior, well, you're missing the point.
I did have to be worried about if Americans are going to not read the book because there are words in there that they don't understand. And then I did get some pressure from fellow Nigerians who said, oh, well, why are you putting some sort of description or explanation of what the words are? You're just catering to the Western audience. You're just catering to the West, you know? And I said, well, you know, I'm an Igbo. And in Nigeria, there are like over 200 different languages. So why do you assume that I'm catering to the West? I could be writing the explanation for my fellow Nigerian who happens to be Yoruba or Hausa who just doesn't speak Igbo.
There's always that tightrope that authors on the international stage must walk. How do you sufficiently demonstrate your culture to the outside world without watering it down? I think Okparanta is totally right about adding explanations, but I also think it's up to the reader to accept that feeling of being an outsider. It might be uncomfortable at first, alienating, even scary, but as we have seen, it's an illuminating place to be.
It's the best way to be.
The thing that was on everyone's mind at the book festival was gentrification. Rents are going up, historically low-income neighborhoods are rapidly becoming middle and even high-income, and that's really bad for the city. The intense mix of cultures is what makes New York, New York, Brooklyn, Brooklyn. It's what gives artists the experience to reflect upon themselves and to make great works of art. And it's not only happening in Brooklyn. San Francisco, London, Moscow are all experiencing it. It's a global phenomenon. I walk around and I see fancy restaurants and bars encroaching on immigrant neighborhoods. I see immigrants being pushed further and further away from the city center. What will happen when New York becomes a sea of expensive eateries and overpriced condos? There's a point where politics, economics, and art meet, and that's on the streets of a city. A literary scene is only as vibrant as its city, and we have to keep our cities vibrant. We'll be right back. Asymptotes podcast was edited by Sally Decker. Special thanks to our voice actors, Alessio Franco and Piali Sham. Our next episode will be out Friday, November 20th. In the meantime, you can check out our fall issue at asymptotejournal.com. Thanks for listening. See you next month.